Thanks to those of you who supported the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. through the charitable grant program of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, Thrivent Choice, we received more than $15,000 last year through Thrivent Choice. Our goal this year is to raise more than $20,000 through Thrivent Choice. For more information on how you can designate charitable outreach funds to Lutheran Public Radio, look for the Thrivent logo under the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org, or ask your Thrivent representative about Thrivent Choice. Help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. with Thrivent Choice. The story itself is familiar to Christians, and several of the gospel writers highlight it. Two of the witnesses there, Peter and John, will later write about it and, well, in some way explain what it is they witnessed there on the mountain when Jesus was transfigured. But what is this about? What does it mean that Jesus takes his disciples to a mountaintop and appears there in divine glory with Moses and Elijah? And according to Luke's account, discusses his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. What is the transfiguration about? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this President's Day. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's also the 20th of February, Monday. Yesterday, many churches celebrated the transfiguration. According to Mark's Gospel, I believe, we will be looking at Luke's Gospel to see what it means there. Luke includes probably the most details of this puzzling account of Jesus shining like the sun. Joining us to talk about the Transfiguration, according to Luke's Gospel, Dr. Arthur Just. He's professor of New Testament and chairman of the Department of Exegetical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of the two-volume Concordia Commentary on Luke and the book Heaven on Earth, The Gifts of Christ in the Divine Service. Dr. Just, welcome back.
Hey, nice to be with you, Todd, and especially to discuss this wonderful text from Luke.
What is the point of the Transfiguration? What's the story about?
Well, I think I would sum it up in what I learned many, many years ago from my professor back when he taught at the seminary, Dr. James Veltz, who now teaches at St. Louis. He always used to call it a glimpse of our heavenly destiny, and I think that's exactly right. In the transfigured body of Jesus, we see what we will someday be. But since then, I've also used the transfiguration as a way of picturing, in some ways, what, you know, our divine service is, what the liturgy is, that it's an experience of heaven on earth, that you have Moses and Elijah coming down from heaven, these heavenly beings, and you have Peter, James, and John with Jesus coming up, these earthly beings, and of course Christ is the center point, you know, the person of Jesus, divine and human nature, God and man, in a way, heaven and earth in one person. They're all joined to him in this covering of glory that appears on the Mount of Transfiguration, and you have, you know, the saints below and the saints above together, and it's a magnificent picture of really what happens every time we gather together around word and sacrament, that we hear the words of Jesus and we participate in the meal of Jesus, and when we do, we are together with all those who have died and risen in Christ. So it's a magnificent, I think, example of what really we experience now. So it's not only a glimpse of our heavenly destiny, but it's a glimpse of our participation now in our heavenly destiny, and what we will one day be when he comes again in glory and we experience the resurrection of the body.
Is there anything unique about Luke's account of the Transfiguration as compared with Matthew and Mark's?
Absolutely. Luke is the one who has, and the only one who has, that wonderful statement how two men were speaking with him, and it makes very clear who they were, Moses and Elijah. And the verb there in the Greek is an imperfect, which means it's an ongoing verb. And I think the idea there is that they are carrying on a conversation in heaven as they come down. And that same conversation that's going on in heaven is what they are talking about when they come down and meet on the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus and the inner three, Peter, James, and John. And it tells us what they're talking about. And again, the word that's used there, those who appeared in glory, were speaking. It's an ongoing verb. They were speaking about his exodus, and that's the literal word, his exodus, which he was about to fulfill in Jerusalem. Now, that's a loaded word. I mean, that word, it implies so many different things. I mean, obviously, first point of departure is the exodus of the children of Israel, and that's the number one redemptive event in the history of Israel. And for a Jew, that is just, I mean, that's Passover, that's blood, that's what the whole thing is about. But there is also, and I mean, I think it's a very clear theme of Luke, this exodus is the journey of Jesus from heaven as he descends into the earth. He kind of breaks in, and I always talk about it as being an invasive sort of almost violent breaking in, born of the Virgin Mary. It's the descent of Jesus and his exodus. Some translations, and departure is okay because we want to somehow render the Greek word exodus in a way that we understand. But it's his departure down into the ground, up out of the ground on the third day, and then back to heaven on the 40th. That's what the exodus is. It's Jesus' journey. And in a sense, that journey is a recapitulation of the journey of the Israelites in the wilderness, their exodus. And Jesus does perfectly what Israel could not do perfectly. Later on, in 9:51 of this chapter, so 20 verses after this, the turning point in Luke's gospel, Jesus turns his face to go to Jerusalem for his lifting up. Now, I mean, you could just say that's directly just the ascension, but I think it's the exodus. It's just a different way of speaking of it. And in order for him to be lifted up, he must descend first through the cross into the grave, and then the third day rise again.
The account of the transfiguration, according to Luke, begins with now about 8 days after these sayings. 8 days after what sayings? What's the context that Luke is setting for us?
Good question. That is the unanswerable question, because Matthew and Mark have a different day. They have 6 days, and so what event? And it does say after these words, 8 days. I don't know. I mean, this is a climactic chapter in Luke. It is as important a chapter as any chapter in all of the gospel. And there's a kind of a symphony of movement from the beginning of it that builds towards the transfiguration. And you have some extraordinarily important events happening here, not just the sending of the 12, which is very important, but the feeding of the 5,000, the confession of Peter that you are the Christ of God, and then the first passion prediction where Jesus, right on the heels of that, says what he must do, then the cost of discipleship. You know, if you want to lose your life, you got to save it. Take up your cross daily and follow me. Luke's the only one who has daily. And then the transfiguration. And I think one of the great themes of Luke 9 is that there's an order to the kingdom, that suffering comes first and then glory. So what does it refer back to? Does it refer back to the feeding of the 5,000? Does it refer back to the confession of Peter? I think there's another thing going on here. And I think Luke wants to ground this in people's understanding at that time of what the number 8 meant. And the number 8 was the eternal number. It was the beginning of the new creation. It was a sign of the resurrection. It has Old Testament precedence that, circumcision was 8 days after birth. There were 8 people on the ark. This is God's end time community. You're either spliced in on the 8th day into God's end-time community in circumcision, or with Noah on the ark, here's the church, Noah and the other 7, and here is where God is going to start again, so to speak, his end-time community. And I do think that the transfiguration is meant to be a foretaste of the resurrection. And I think Luke is making it explicit by using the word eight. Now, not everybody agrees with me on that. If you read my commentary, you'll see that I'll offer, you know, a number of different commentators who don't take it that way. But there are some who do. And I think if you just look at the way Luke uses numbers and the way in which he is, in a sense, the gospel of the resurrection, no one has more about the resurrection than Luke does, that I think this is really a good possibility that we are referring now to the transfiguration as a foretaste, and it's how we began, a foretaste of our eternal destiny, of what we will one day be. It's a foretaste of the resurrection, and then the resurrection of the body when Christ comes again in glory.
So with about a minute here before the break, one thing I note is that he takes Peter, James, and John, and they go up to the mountain. It seems, maybe I'm reading too much into it, that Luke assumes we know what mountain he's talking about.
I think that's true, and there's a nice debate about that too, Todd, and it's either Mount Tabor, which is sort of the tradition. I mean, and if you go to Israel, if they want to take you to the Mount of Transfiguration, they'll take you to Mount Tabor. But there's also a good possibility, and many people who are very, very open to the fact, and I'm one of them, that this is Mount Hermon. And Mount Hermon is where, you know, the source of the Jordan, it's right there above Caesarea Philippi, so it's near Damascus, you know, and it's a snow-covered mountain during the winter, at least, and it is where the water comes that feeds the Jordan and really feeds that entire part of Palestine. And I think one of the reasons why Mount Hermon is a good possibility is because right before this, when Peter says, "You are the Christ of God," that happens in Caesarea Philippi. And probably the Passion prediction too, and probably Jesus' teaching about the cost of discipleship. So they would have gone right up to the mountain there, which is Mount Hermon.
We'll take a break. We'll talk more about the Transfiguration according to the Gospel of Luke with Dr. Arthur Just on this Monday afternoon, February the 20th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
When you need a friend, you have a friend in Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd, and friends among his people at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri. At Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, we offer Christ-centered word and sacrament ministry, inspirational liturgical worship services, and faithful preaching and teaching. Sunday worship services are at 9 a.m. Sunday school and Bible class are at 10:30. We also have an excellent Christian preschool. We invite you to join us. Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, 2211 Tenbrook Road, Arnold, Missouri, 636-296-1292.
You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org.
There's an app for that.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hi, this is Jonathan Collin from France.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
First, I would like to say thank you very much for your program. It very much ministers to those of us who are outside the comforts and the luxuries of having a confessional Lutheran congregation nearby. Thank you very much for this great resource.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
Jesus on the mountain peak stands alone in glory blazing. Let us, if we dare to speak, join the saints and angels pray.
the first stanza of Jesus on the Mountain Peak. We're talking about the transfiguration of Jesus according to the Gospel of Luke. Dr. Arthur Just is our guest. Here's what one of our listeners, Sam in California, posted recently about the new Issues Etc. iPhone app. Sam says, love the new app for the iPhone. I can listen in my car or walking my baby girl around in the stroller. We definitely have issues here in Huntington Beach. Well, thank you very much, Sam. And thanks to everybody who's downloaded and are using the Issues Etc. iPhone app or the Issues Etc. Android app. They're both free, a way of saying thank you to our listeners. And with them, you can take Issues Etc. wherever you go. I like to think of it as Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. You can find the app at our website, issuesetc.org. If you use an Android-based device, well, we've got one for you. And if you use the iPhone or an iPad, it works there as well, the iPhone app. For Issues Etc. Take Issues Etc. wherever you go. Issuesetc.org on the homepage. You can also find a way to download them under the Listen menu there at our website, issuesetc.org. Dr. Just, he goes to the mountain to pray, but it is, and Luke is careful to note this, it is while he is praying that the actual transfiguration takes place. This would have been, I mean, at least as far as I can tell from Luke and Mark's gospel in particular, this is routine for Jesus to go someplace with the inner circle to pray.
That's exactly right. In fact, I think even more than Mark, Luke is the praying gospel, and Jesus always prays at significant moments. We just studied the temptation of Jesus in Luke's gospel, and I mean, it's framed by prayer. He goes into the Garden of Gethsemane in order to pray, and you know, chastises his disciples. Why are they falling asleep while he's praying? And then, you know, tells them to pray again. I mean, it is a significant part of the way in which Jesus is pictured in Luke's gospel as somebody who spends time with his Father in prayer. And this is why he goes up, and it's in order to pray. And you're absolutely right. You've observed, and it's a very sort of typical Lucan expression, you know, grammatical expression, while he's praying, this thing happened. And this is the same sort of parallel to the baptism, that while he's praying, you know, he's baptized. While he's praying, you have this moment of glory. Now, both of these, I refer to baptism because this is the frame of our Epiphany season. We began with baptism. We began with Jesus praying, and we began with the heavens open and the Father saying, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." Now the Epiphany season ends with the Transfiguration, and the Father saying, "This is my I think it's the elect one. I want to make sure I get that right. I think it says in the Transfiguration. Do you have it there, Todd? I think, yeah, his elect one, mm-hmm. His elect one, you know, in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him, you know. It is a voice of the Father that affirms the identity of the Son during this season in which Jesus is manifested, and we see who he is. And the praying is such a big part of it. And the fact that really what he is doing as he kind of goes up the mountain is he's, in a sense, showing them how one does, you know, kind of ascend to the Father in prayer, and the Father comes to us in prayer, so that in prayer we are, in a way, united with God. Not in any sort of, you know, I mean, and Lutherans are always very careful about this, not in any sort of sacramental way, but I mean, really, you can see this in the Garden of Gethsemane. What we're doing in prayer is saying, may the will of the Father in heaven and our wills become one. And that's really all that Jesus is doing when he prays to the Father. And I think the idea of going up to the mountain shows the sense of this. There is something of prayers ascending. Prayer's going to the Father, and he literally walks up the mountain to the Father.
There's a strange, and I'm going to have to, you know, defer to you on how we get the English translation we do on the actual transfiguration, because we're talking here about an altering of the appearance of his face. That's how Luke describes it.
Yeah.
In a kind of, if I'm not mistaken in my Greek, a kind of wooden way.
Yeah, it is. He says that the appearance, the form of his face became as another.
Yeah, it doesn't even have the word became in there. It's just...
No, it doesn't.
The form of his face, another, or the other.
That's when we study this in class, that opening, you know, the and it happened and it came to pass, that verb actually is intended in the Greek to be transported down and inserted. So it does...
Really, all the way from verse 28.
Yeah, in verse 28. 29. I'm looking at 29. You know, while he was praying...
And it happened.
...came to pass that while he was praying... That verb that we translate and it came to pass, the kai geneta that you got there, mm-hmm. that geneta happened is to be brought down and inserted in the next two phrases. That's sort of intentional.
So this is something that Luke, I think, notes. The other talk about his face shining like the sun. Here it's his garments that shine. Obviously, they're not mutually exclusive. But
no.
his appearance is altered, and I wonder here whether or not there are hints in the prayer, the sleepiness of the disciples, they don't recognize him. Is Luke here foreshadowing the passion and the resurrection account that he will tell us later?
Oh, he absolutely is. I mean, and it actually there's a parallel here to Emmaus, because what happens to the Emmaus disciples and what happens to the disciples here on the mountain are basically the same thing, and that is that when you're, as a human being, when you're in the presence of the kind of the extraordinary glory that happens at the transfiguration and the resurrection, you become confused. You don't recognize things. Things that should be obvious to you don't appear to be obvious. And in fact, it can be so kind of overwhelming, even frightening, that as it happens, I mean, psychologists will tell you that people simply shut down. They fall asleep. They just retreat into themselves. They it's like a computer just going to sleep. You know, just all systems down. And that's the power of the glory of God. We can't even imagine what something like that is. And the disciples were there is a sense of confusion and not being able to really see in a way that you can see, you know, in normal life without that glory.
So his clothing becomes dazzling white. One of the gospel writers says, whiter than any launderer could make it.
Right, right. And what's great about this is Luke does this all the way through. There is a parallel in Luke between the transfiguration, the resurrection, and the ascension. And it's done in a couple of ways. The one between the transfiguration and the resurrection that's so interesting is that the garments become, and here Jesus is extra white. So it's got the X in front of it, like, remember the toothpaste, extra gleaming white? Whereas the angels, when they appear at the resurrection, they don't get the X, they just get the gleaming, you know? Same word, but without the extra. You know, and so you can see that there's a parallel to the angels anticipating the extra gleaming Jesus who's going to appear to the Emmaus disciples. But we do have this manifestation of glory, and it renders things. I mean, like Moses coming down from Mount Sinai. There's another example. I mean, he goes white. You know, and it's there is a sense of disorientation there as well. I mean, the glory of God is beyond human capacity to comprehend. And that's what we're getting here. And that's what we get at the resurrection. And it's, you know, I mean, there is a sense that they not only are confused, but they don't even know how to explain it to anyone. So there's no report of it, in a sense. You know, and they're really commanded not to in some cases as well. But you know, how can you explain this? How do you possibly, you know, tell somebody what you've experienced?
With about a minute here, take us to the appearance of Moses and Elijah. And Luke doesn't so much emphasize their appearance, but their conversation that you mentioned before.
Yeah, I mean, Moses and Elijah are just sort of the way in which people think of the Old Testament back then, the law and the prophets. I mean, that's sort of a standard reading on this. But, you know, both of them had experiences of glory. You know, I just mentioned Moses, and of course Elijah, you know, he doesn't die. He's assumed into heaven. So, I mean, it's as if there is sort of no, you know, blip there for him. I mean, he's in a state that he's always been since he was assumed into heaven. And what you have here is the two witnesses. The Old Testament demands that there be two witnesses. And the three disciples who really are privy to the most intimate moments of Jesus' life, they're the ones at the Garden of Gethsemane, for example. They're the ones who see the resurrection of Jairus' daughter. And, of course, here at the Transfiguration, these three are in a sense, seeing the testimony of the Old Testament in Moses and Elijah that says this is the Messiah.
Dr. Arthur Just is our guest. We're talking about the Transfiguration according to the Gospel of Luke on this Monday afternoon, February the 20th. This is Issues Etc. Issues Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are four levels of giving. The Confessor, $25 monthly, or an annual gift of $250. The Apologist, $50 monthly, or an annual gift of $500. The Reformer, $100 monthly, or an annual gift of $1,000. And the Patron, $200 monthly, or an annual gift of $2,000. Each Reformation Club member receives premiums like books, transcripts, and the I Have Issues t-shirt. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by contacting Craig. His email address, craig@issuesetc.org. Or you can call 618-223-8385. 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
The faith, once for all, delivered to the saints. You're listening to Issues Etc.
A stem cell update.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Embryonic stem cell research has failed to produce any tangible results. This fact, however, did not prevent the Obama administration from recently increasing funding for such research. Adult stem cell research, however, has proved quite fruitful. For instance, the Wake Forest Institute of Regenerative Medicine recently announced they used adult stem cells to engineer ears, fingers, blood vessels, and entire organs. Doctors have also used the stem cells of their patients to grow cheekbones and a spinal disc for patients. This is ethical and productive research, and it's research that works.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
We're talking about the Transfiguration according to the Gospel of Luke. Dr. Arthur Just is our guest. He's professor of New Testament and chairman of the Department of Exegetical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of the two-volume Concordia Commentary on Luke and the book Heaven on Earth, The Gifts of Christ in the Divine Service. Dr. Just, they speak of his departure. Now, you talked about this at the very beginning of our conversation, that word exodus there. Would this include not only Christ's suffering, crucifixion, resurrection, but also his ascension into heaven, the whole sweep of that divine activity?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It has to. It embraces all of that. And I, you know, that's something that I find myself always saying now, but I have to consciously think, You know, we always used to say suffering and resurrection, but we must include the ascension. I mean, the ascension is such a huge part of the whole program of the divine plan that is set in motion, and you know, we see the ascension as being, you know, one of the four great feast days of the year, with Christmas, Epiphany, and Easter, Ascension and Pentecost, five, I should say. And it is, and it does include that. What's really fascinating to me, though, is when you think of it in this way, that what they're talking about in heaven is the death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus and his suffering. That this is, and I always say it this way, this is what, you know, the language of Revelation, where you hear the heavenly chorus. What are they singing? They're singing about the Lamb who was slain and raised again. And that raised again includes the ascension. That's the song of heaven, you know. That's what they're singing in heaven. That's what we're going to be doing for an eternity. Now, if this is a picture of our liturgy, and if this is what the inner three were given a glimpse of on the Mount of Transfiguration, of what their heavenly destiny is, and in a way what they should be doing right now, then when we gather together around the presence of Christ in word and sacrament, what we need to hear is about the Lamb who was slain and raised again. If we're not hearing that, then there's something wrong. We're not then experiencing the kind of worship that is the worship of the transfiguration of heaven on earth. And I think that's, I mean, when I talk about it in those, in that way with people, and especially with lay people, I think they resonate to that. I think they see this as, yeah, that's why I'm coming. I'm coming to worship to be part of this heavenly chorus, you know. And I mean, in a way, that's what the ordinaries do. I mean, the Gloria especially, and the Sanctus and the Agnus Dei, you know, they're Trinitarian Christological hymns. I mean, they're about the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. That's Gloria and Agnus Dei. That's what we should be singing. That's what we should be focusing on. That's the center of our joy. And that's what the Transfiguration is all about. That's what it's teaching us. You know, and this is an ongoing conversation. It's never stopped. It's always going on in heaven, and it's always going on earth, wherever people are gathered together, you know, around the presence of Christ and his angels and archangels and the whole company of heaven.
Is it safe to say there's nothing better to talk about? I mean, it's not as though if there were something better to talk about in heaven, they'd be talking about it. It sounds like that's the best thing that they consider to be the subject of conversation.
Well, I'd rather talk about social justice, Todd, you know, and all the issues that are associated with, you know, I mean, we could certainly refer to those things. I'm being facetious here, but yeah, it is the heart of what we are. It's of who we are, and it's our identity. It's why we come to join ourselves to that person of Jesus and all that he is and all that he's done and all who are in him. And, you know, we can't see Jesus apart from his resurrected body with the wounds, you know, and that's why the Transfiguration isn't the full picture, because really the full picture comes through the wounds as well in the resurrected body of Jesus. That's why it's just a glimpse. It's not the full picture. But, I mean, that's exactly right. There is nothing better. There's nothing that we should really talk about except that.
It says this was his exodus that he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. When it sounds to me like Luke is saying, this is really the point of the whole story. I mean, I'm not going to tip my hand too much to you, but this is where this story's going that I'm telling you.
Right. I totally agree. And I think in some ways, I mean, if you look at the history of the Gospels, if Luke is sort of the last of the synoptics, you know, he's the one who does include this to make sure that, you know, you don't miss it. I mean, you might, there are some who may, in reading Matthew and Mark, not quite fully understand that this is what happens on the Mount of Transfiguration. He sort of lays it out for us so that we can't have any doubt at all that when Jesus comes and Moses and Elijah comes, this is what happens. My guess is that especially Matthew, if it is the earliest gospel like I think it is, I mean, Jews would have sort of assumed this, that maybe this is something that needs to be spelled out for people who are not Jews, like Gentiles, which really is sort of the audience of Luke's gospel. But boy, it couldn't be clearer. And the wonderful thing about, you know, preaching on the Transfiguration in Luke's gospel is it's pretty hard to miss the gospel here. It's pretty hard to miss that the center of everything is the exodus of Jesus, which, as we've said, suffering, death, resurrection, and ascension. I mean, that is what it's all about. I mean, and that's what really everything should be about in a sense.
Peter and James and John almost, according to Luke's account, sleep through this. They wake up and only become fully aware of what's going on just as Moses and Elijah are parting from Christ. And can you explain to us what's going on with Peter in his suggestion as to how they, round off this whole experience?
Well, you know, Peter is next to Jesus, the person in the New Testament that we really know the most about. I mean, I suppose you could say Paul, too, because he wrote so many letters, and there's some self-revealing in them, so we really do have a sense of Paul's personality. But in the Gospels, Peter and Jesus, and we really do get a sense of what Peter's like. And I think, you know, what we've heard in Sunday school and what we've heard in sermons about Peter as being a born leader, impetuous, sort of, you know, kind of leads, you know, with his mouth before he realizes what he's fully saying. I mean, Luke actually, I think, says it here. He knows not what he says. And I think Peter here is just responding completely, totally to the moment. And the moment is, I mean, once he wakes up and sees it, I think he understands it. I mean, it's Moses, Elijah, it's Jesus, it's glory. This is heaven. Let's build tents. Let's stay here. Let's not go back down the mountain. Let's stay right here. This is what it's all about. This is the goal that we all, you know, are, you know, hoping to receive in the end. This is our destiny. I'm not going back down. I don't want to go back down. Let's, you know, and it, they build tents, tabernacles. That's why they think this happened somewhere near the Feast of Tabernacles, which I think is likely. But he wants to preserve the glory, the moment here. And in a way, you know, I mean, Luke is kind when he says he knows not what he says, you know, and even though it doesn't occur in Luke's gospel where he after the passion prediction in Matthew says, you know, let it never be so, Lord, and that's where Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. I mean, in a way, Peter sort of is not recognizing at this moment that the order of the kingdom is Jesus does have to go back down the mountain. He does have to turn his face, go to Jerusalem. He has to make that journey there, and he needs to be lifted up on the cross. That the suffering is the only way in which you enter into glory. And, you know, Luke makes that clear at Emmaus. When Jesus finally, you know, kind of interrupts the Emmaus disciples' lament about what happened to him, you know, and they have that really wonderful sort of confession of faith that is beautiful. They just don't fully understand it, comprehend it, or even in a sense believe it. Jesus interrupts them. And the way in which Jesus speaks gospel to them, this is the Emmaus disciples. These are Jesus' first kind of spoken words of theological content. He says, was it not necessary that the Christ suffer and then enter into his glory? Now that's shorthand for the whole teaching of what we've been talking about, the Lamb who was slain and raised again. And Jesus kind of summarizes his whole passion, his suffering, his death on the cross as suffer. The Christ must suffer. And then the resurrection is described as entrance into glory. You know, and what Peter, you know, is experiencing on the mountain is this entrance into glory. And he doesn't want to go down the mountain. He wants to stay there. And, I identify with Peter. If I had that situation, I'd want to do the same, you know. In many ways, Peter got it right, you know. I mean, he just, you know, sort of missed the suffering part.
We'll take a break when we come back. 10 more minutes on this Monday afternoon, February the 20th, with Dr. Arthur Just. We're talking about the transfiguration according to the Gospel of Luke. Dr. Just is professor of New Testament and chairman of the Department of Exegetical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. When we come back, Peter doesn't get his entire plan out. We don't know what else he had planned because the Father speaks and in a way explains to Peter, James, John, and us what this whole thing was all about. We'll be right back.
Wouldn't it be great if more of your fellow parishioners listened to Issues Etc.? Well, here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. The bulletin blurb is updated weekly. issuesetc.org. Stay connected. issuesetc.org.
What are church elders responsible for? How can we build trust between pastors and elders? And how can we hold one another accountable? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February is titled Pastors and Elders, Caring for the Church and One Another. You can check it out at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Pastors and Elders by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, Pastors and Elders.
Christological, Creedal, Confessional. You're listening to Issues Etc.
How does Jesus' incarnation provide us with a response to religious relativism? Find out in an article that I've written for the latest Issues Etc. journal. It's titled God in a Box, and we'll send it to you for free. Just send an email to journal@issuesetc.org. You can also read about Pastor Michael Schuerman's journey from moralistic therapeutic deism to the rock-solid theology of the Reformation. The online Issues Etc. journal, journal@issuesetc.org.
If any former evangelicals are hearing me speak right now, I want to assure you, you don't have to be a homeless Christian. If you would go to issuesetc.org, look on their website, you'll find a list of churches. Find one close to you and attend that church. There, you can receive the true gospel, you don't have to be a homeless Christian, and they will not call you a backslider.
To find a church near you, go to issuesetc.org and click Find a Church.
Tis good, Lord, to be here. Thy glory fills the night. Thy face and garments like the sun shine with unborrowed light.
The first stanza of Tis Good, Lord, to be here, a great transfiguration hymn, as we talk about the transfiguration, according to Luke's gospel. We could call this Transfiguration Monday. I think, Monday, February the 20th, Dr. Arthur Just is our guest. Last week, we concluded a short series with the author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February on the book Pastors and Elders, Caring for One Another and for the Church. Some of you probably got a mass email about that, pointing you to those interviews. This book is a great resource, kind of simple groundwork explaining the relationship of pastor to elders in the congregation, giving some great examples of how to do it right, how to do it wrong, and then at the back of the book, there's an appendix of some form letters. That sounds pretty dry. They're actually well-written, well-considered letters that you can use as a model to communicate with your congregation. Elders often have to send out those letters that say, where have you been? Would you come back to church? Or problems with discipline. That kind of practical help you will find in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, Pastors and Elders from Concordia Publishing House. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. The book is called Pastors and Elders by Pastor Timothy Mack. Dr. Just, Peter doesn't get to finish his suggestion before the Father speaks from heaven. He's not identified as the Father except that he declares Christ to be his Son. And you said the word he uses there, my elect, my chosen. Chosen for what?
Chosen to go back down the mountain and go to the cross. But also chosen to be the new Moses, the Deuteronomy 18:15 prophet like unto Moses, but greater than Moses. Because right after he says, the chosen one, the elect one, and I misspoke myself. It's in some of the variant readings, in whom I am well pleased. That's just at the baptism. It goes right from the chosen one, listen to him. And that is a direct reference to the Moses prophecy. Now, what I always find really interesting is the fact that, you know, in Luke's gospel, the feeding of the 5,000 is clearly sort of portrayed as the Moses miracle. In fact, if you read Matthew and you read Mark, there's a big bunch of passages between the feeding of the 5,000 and Peter's confession that Jesus is the Christ. And I think Luke puts them right together there because he wants us to see that it's the confession that Jesus is the Christ that comes after Peter sees that incredible moment in the feeding of the 5,000 and recognizes and sees Jesus as the Christ there. And I think, you know, the Transfiguration sort of reiterates that. Moses comes down from the mountain to testify, this is the Christ. And then the Father says to the three, listen to him, which is a quote. I mean, if you look at your Greek New Testaments in the margin there, it says Deuteronomy 18:15, listen to him. This is the new Moses. This is the one who was prophesied, who is greater than Moses. This is the Messiah. This is the elect one. You know, this is my son. So this is an extraordinary thing for those inner three to hear and witness before they come down the mountain. They're about to turn their face to go to Jerusalem with Jesus. They have some really rough days ahead. And, you know, it says they're silent and they don't report this to anyone. I mean, they're sort of, I think, pretty overwhelmed by this. I don't think we realize how overwhelming the ministry of Jesus, his teaching, what happens to him, how overwhelming all that is for them. But this is just, I mean, it undoes them. They just don't quite know how to handle this. And yet they will always have ringing in their ears, even during those darkest moments, during his suffering. This is my son, the elect one. Listen to him. You know, and I think after the resurrection, that very statement again, you know, they now hear it in light of the resurrection. But what they do then is they go back into the Old Testament, as Jesus instructs them to do after he rose from the dead, and read the entire Old Testament Christologically through him, you know, and listen to the voice of Jesus in the Old Testament. Listen to him speak, you know, in every passage that there is in the Old Testament, because it's his voice that you're hearing. It's his story. It's the story, you know, of God's redemptive acts to buy for himself a people upon which he puts his name. And that's, you know, as you read the New Testament, that's a people of Jews and Gentiles, you know, which is the kind of the amazing, you know, revelation that the book of Acts is really about, and Paul in his missionary journeys is about. But I mean, that's the command of the Father to listen to Jesus, you know. And again, I mean, we should be paying attention to that. That's what we should be doing. I mean, we should be listening to Jesus. And how do we listen to Jesus? By simply, you know, devoting ourselves to the apostles' teaching, to fellowship and the breaking of bread and prayers, by dwelling in Scripture richly. I mean, that's that again, going back to the liturgy, that's what our liturgy should be. And I mean, that's what the historic, kind of the great tradition of liturgy is. It's dwelling in the Scriptures richly. That's what our preaching should be. That's who we are. That's what we're about. You know, listening to Jesus.
Talk briefly, if you would, about how both Peter and John reflect on this years later. I mean, you said ringing in their ears. It's ringing in their ears for the rest of their ministry. Peter writes about it in one of his epistles, and John alludes to it at the beginning of his gospel. We beheld his glory, that of the only begotten Son of the Father. And Peter talks about Jesus being given honor by the Father when he appeared in divine majesty.
Yeah, I think... you know, it is interesting that that is when they now speak about it. And, you know, I mean, both Peter and John, those things are written many, many decades after the Transfiguration. And yet they now are in a position, because they've seen the whole end of the story. They've seen not only the resurrection and the ascension, but they've seen a church grow that has gathered around, you know, the hidden glory of Jesus in the preaching of the church and in the sacramental life of the church. I mean, they have entered into that glory, so to speak, as they've received the body and blood of Christ. And I think they, what both of them are trying to do, both John and Peter, is to tell their people, yeah, it's not as kind of, you know, I mean, blow your socks off sort of glory that we had on the Mount of Transfiguration, but it's still the crucified and risen, glorified Christ that we are receiving when we receive his word and we eat and drink his body and blood. I mean, I think that is what, and they say this is almost in some ways better. You know, he has tabernacled among us, and he continues to tabernacle among us. And I you know, John and Peter are writing, you know, with the long view in mind. And even though I think both of them had an expectation that Jesus might come again soon, they knew that he was already here now, that he was here among us in the life of the church, in the sacramental life of the church, in the liturgy of the church, which really all amount to the same thing. He's here because Jesus is here bodily, giving us his gifts. And as we love to say as Lutherans, those gifts are forgiveness, life, and salvation.
Dr. Arthur Just is professor of New Testament and chairman of the Department of Exegetical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, author of the two-volume Concordia Commentary on Luke and the book Heaven on Earth, The Gifts of Christ in the Divine Service. Dr. Just, thanks for being our guest.
My pleasure, and a blessed Transfiguration Week to everyone.
Folks, if you appreciate in-depth Bible study like this one, please consider joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club in 2012. It's our monthly or annual giving program. Membership benefits include items like the I Have Issues t-shirt books, broadcast transcripts, advertising for your congregation, the list goes on. Find out more about the Issues Etc. Reformation Club at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses and join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club today. He appears briefly, very briefly, in his divine glory manifested in his body, borne witness to by all of the Old Testament, by the prophetic voices that continue to testify of him today. That's what Jesus says. And the voice that comes out of the bright cloud says, listen to him. It's quite right. To listen to Scripture, Old Testament and New Testament, is to listen to the very living voice of Jesus Christ, crucified and risen from the dead. He speaks there. He speaks and we listen, and by his speaking, we are made able to hear and listen and believe what he says. And even more than that, this is not some disembodied voice. This is, in fact, the voice of Christ who is in his body and blood, in his incarnation, still among us, saving sinners by that death, that resurrection, that ascension. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.